Welcome to Profiles. I'm Steve Sanders. On this episode, we meet a medical doctor, clinical scientist, educator, and jazz musician who is successor to the mantle of Alfred Kinsey, founder of the world-famous Institute for Sex Research at Indiana University. John Bancroft, welcome to Profiles.
It's good to be here.
John, sex is for some merely a bodily, biological function. For others, a form of recreation. For most people, a way to express love and to reproduce. And for some, it's something sacred. What makes sex something that's a compelling and appropriate subject for academic researchers, something that should be studied within the context of a great university like IU?
It's difficult to think of any aspect of the human condition which is more fundamental than sex and all the things that go with it that you listed. And yet at the same time, it is a subject which has been taboo for scientific research for a considerable period of time and to a considerable extent. And Alfred Kinsey was one of the people who blasted his way through those taboos. But still today, there are obstacles and barriers to researching sexual behavior. And yet there are huge problems in society associated with sexuality.
And we're going to talk over the course of the next hour about some of those problems and particularly some of the research that you have been involved in and the contributions that the Kinsey Institute has made and continues to make. But first, let's start out talking about you and your personal background. Born in Peterborough, England, you've said you knew from an early age, perhaps 9 or 10, that you wanted to be a doctor. And you ultimately did receive your MD from Cambridge University. What influenced you in that direction?
I don't quite understand why that happened, but I do remember when I was about 9 being fascinated by biology classes on the subject of malaria, and it seemed to go from there, and it was slightly odd, actually.
How so?
Well, I think it's unusual for children to be so focused on a particular career at that age, and I wouldn't encourage it. Certainly my kids have not been like that, so I was a little bit bizarre in that respect.
Did you ever have any doubts, or did you really know from your earliest sort of awareness that this was your destiny?
Yes, I never had any doubts.
You did spend some, what I gather were some unhappy years in boarding school, and in various ways that experience had a profound effect on your adult attitudes. Talk about some of that. What happened? What were those influences? And how did they affect the person you later became and your work?
I was sent away to boarding school when I was 8. I wouldn't recommend it. I think it may be okay for some kids, but it didn't suit me. It reflected the fact that things weren't going particularly well in my family. So it's conceivable that I might have not been any better off staying at home. But anyway, I was very homesick and for the first few years, very unhappy there. Got better towards the end. But it was in a school environment which was very sort of sexist and conservative in its values and attitudes. And I reacted to that. And I think this played quite a strong part in my becoming a fairly left-of-center, politically oriented individual.
Describe the setting of the school. This was a boarding school in England. Presumably it was a single-sex environment, not a co-educational environment.
Oh, absolutely.
Did that dynamic have an effect on your attitudes?
I mean, I have 3 sisters. But apart from my sisters, really the only contact I had with females as a growing up child and adolescent was when I went to Mrs. Harding's dance classes, and that contact with females was pretty ritualized, I have to say. Otherwise, I would be with boys throughout the school term. I would go back to my family and live in the countryside and not have any contact with the opposite sex. So I was pretty segregated. Mm-hmm. I think that had an influence on my sexual development as well.
A positive influence or a negative influence?
No, a negative influence. I didn't understand the opposite sex. I was fairly unsure of myself and inhibited, and my family didn't help me in that respect either. Okay. It took me a long time to overcome that handicapped start.
Okay. Your educational path led you to Cambridge, where you eventually earned your MD. What led you specifically into the branch of medical practice of psychiatry?
Well, having known from a peculiarly early age that I wanted to be a doctor, when I was quite a young teenager, certainly 14 or so, I became very interested in behavior. At that stage, I was very interested in animal behavior. And it was a natural progression from there, having decided that I was going to be a doctor, to look at the more behavioral aspects of medicine.
Okay. Trace for us, just describe the timeline of your early work in medicine. You fairly early became a clinician, focused on clinical work, working on practical issues and the practical problems of your patients. Is that correct? But you've also done research on hormonal influences of sex. Just talk about the progression of your intellectual and your academic work in those early years.
Okay. Well, I wanted to be a doctor and I wanted to be a psychiatrist by the time I got to Cambridge. So I went through the training, which was 6 years. And then by then I knew I wanted to be in academic psychiatry. I didn't want to be just a clinician. And in order to get a good career in academic psychiatry, you needed to get establish yourself in general medicine first. So I went into general medicine. I trained in that until I became a member of the Royal College of Physicians, which is a sort of career stage in equivalent to boards in the United States. And then I started my training in psychiatry. I went after a few years, having been at the Institute of Psychiatry in London, I went to Oxford University to help start a new department of psychiatry at the university there. I spent 7 years there, and in 1976, I went up to Edinburgh to join the Medical Research Council Reproductive Biology Unit, which is the point in my career when I clearly was focusing on, firstly, research and sexuality and reproduction.
And you were about what age at that point? How early in your career was that?
Well, I was 76. I would have been 40 when I went up to Edinburgh.
Okay. One thing you said I thought was interesting. You mentioned that you helped to found a program in psychiatry at Oxford. That implies that the academic study of psychiatry as a discipline, or at least in the context in which you were working, was fairly new. It's not an ancient discipline that has been around at Oxford for years and years and years.
Oxford is a very traditional university, and so it's probably behind less traditional universities in establishing relatively modern programs. And there were certainly other programs in psychiatry in other medical schools around the country when it was started in Oxford.
What then led, you said by that point you were focusing more and more on human sexuality in your work. What accounted for that focus of your interests?
Well, I became interested in behavioral methods of modifying behavior, which was a sort of new vogue in the 60s. One of the areas of behavior that these new behavioral techniques focused on was sexual behavior. And I got into that, initially modifying sexual preferences, believe it or not. That didn't last very long.
This meaning specifically the idea that those with a gay or lesbian, a homosexual orientation could be changed in some way to have a heterosexual orientation.
That's right. They wouldn't have, in those days, of identified themselves as gay, but that was a time when homosexual men were still quite often coming along seeking help to change because they were so heavily stigmatized, I mean, even more so than they are today. That phase didn't last very long because it didn't work, but I also got involved in other aspects of sexuality which really appealed to me intellectually, and that's where I've been since, basically.
Mm-hmm. You did some early work in what has come to be called reparative therapy, the idea that homosexual orientation can be changed to heterosexual. You said you discovered early on that was a failure, that was a dead end. You've said in other interviews that for a while you became sort of an ardent Freudian. In fact, you've said that early in your career, you, after these experiences, I gather, you lost faith in grand theories that explained human behavior. How did that disillusionment, if that's the right word, influence your later research and your later clinical practice?
I started off preoccupied with psychoanalysis and Freud when I was a medical student. And it was in the clinical phase of my training that I started to move away from psychoanalysis. I went through some sort of conversion reaction. And that was when I flipped into the behavioral mode, was influenced by what was then called modern learning theory. And I was involved in research, testing it out, and became disillusioned with it. I thought it was simplistic and not particularly helpful. So from then on, I became a rather more conventional positivist scientist who was testing relatively limited and somewhat fragmented hypotheses rather than being guided by any sort of overarching theoretical model. That has changed, I'm pleased to say, in the last few years, but that was the case for most of my career.
Okay. And we'll talk about how some of that change was brought about by or intersected with what eventually brought you to Bloomington, Indiana, to direct the Kinsey Institute. We're going to take a break now to listen to some music, which is a typical feature of the Profiles program. We're fortunate that you have brought along some of your own music because one of your identities, avocations, is as a musician. Talk for a bit about the role that music has played in your life. You play jazz piano, both solo and in ensembles, I gather. How did you come to music? Is it strictly a hobby? Is it integrated in some more fundamental way to your intellectual interests? What role does music play in your life?
Music is very, very important in my life. I've never been particularly good at it. But I've enjoyed it immensely. So I started to learn to play the piano when I was quite young. I didn't get very far with that. I didn't develop as I should have done with lessons. But when I got to Cambridge, I became involved in the jazz world there, and that was very exciting. In fact, I really thought about nothing else when I was a medical student, at least a preclinical medical student. All of my non-academic time was spent with jazz musicians and listening to jazz and playing it. Subsequently, obviously, I became more involved in my career, but I continued to play and would periodically be part of a group. And for the last few years that I was in Edinburgh, I actually was playing vibraphone at that time. And then when I came to Bloomington, I bought my vibraphone with me, and I've never touched it since. I bought myself a very good keyboard. After the first few years, when I hardly touched it, I started playing, and now I play almost every day, and I love it. Mm-hmm. And I've focused on, because I'm on my own and I don't play with other musicians now, I've become very interested in solo jazz piano, and I listen to a lot of recordings of solo jazz piano.
The cut we're going to listen to is Like Someone in Love. This is from a CD that's been produced of your own music, your piano solos, your jazz piano solos. Why this particular cut?
It's probably the only chance I'm going to have my playing on the radio, and I thought this was the one that I would probably choose, I would prefer to share with everybody else.
That was the song Like Someone in Love, composed by Johnny Burke and Jimmy Van Heusen, and performed by our guest on Profiles, John Bancroft, director of the Kinsey Institute. John, some commentators and historians of jazz have described jazz music both as an inherently American musical form and also in some ways a sexual musical form, a musical form that seems to embody or seems to convey a certain sexuality. Do you buy into that idea?
To a limited extent. I think in the early days of jazz, it should be regarded as an important form of popular music, and popular music in general, I think, tends to convey sexual messages. It certainly does nowadays. I think as time has gone on, the place of jazz has become somewhat different. But there's a sensuality about a lot of jazz. Mm-hmm. But then there is other types of music too. Mm-hmm.
This year, 2003, marks the 50th anniversary of the publication of Alfred Kinsey's book on female sexuality. The first volume on male sexuality having been published 5 years earlier. 2003 is also the 50th anniversary of the year that 1953, that Time magazine put Alfred Kinsey on its cover. In recent years, there's been something of a reassessment of Kinsey. Several new biographies were published about him in the last 5 years or so. There's also been some vilification of Kinsey by various political and cultural elements and commentators. If you were talking to a new student or a new faculty member at Indiana University who might not have even been aware that the Kinsey Institute is here, in just very broad outline, what would you say it was essential for a person like that to know about Alfred Kinsey?
Well, Kinsey was a very unusual man, and he pioneered what you might call modern sex research. There wasn't anything like it before. There were a number of studies that had been done, but they were fairly restrained and limited. And Kinsey sort of blasted his way through the taboos and restrictions on studying sex that prevailed at that time to carry out a study which is still bigger than anything else that has been done. I mean, from an early age, I have been amazed at the enormity of Kinsey's work and effort. As an Englishman, I've sort of seen it as an example of the bigness of the United States. But Kinsey, he had a huge undertaking, which unfortunately prematurely led to his death, I think. His work was not just huge, but it was detailed and meticulous. One can find limitations and mistakes that he made and errors of judgment. But I have enormous respect for him as a scholar. I suspect he was probably a difficult man to work with, but he had huge compassion, in particular for the people that he encountered who were suffering in various ways from the sort of repressive society that existed at that time, who were suffering from their sexuality because of the sex negativism that prevailed. He was a very compassionate man. He had considerable integrity, and I have great respect for him.
Okay. The Kinsey Institute is marking this year the 50th anniversary of Sexual Behavior in the Human Female, the second of Kinsey's two landmark volumes on male and female sexuality. The Institute's marking the anniversary with a number of special events. We should probably say that listeners can go to the Kinsey Institute's website to find information about those events, many of which are taking place in February of 2003. The website is www.kinseyinstitute.org. John, how well has Kinsey's work specifically on women, which the events and conferences and other things are focused on this year, how well has Kinsey's work on women specifically stood the test of time? What of his insights and discoveries endures, and where was Kinsey wrong?
Well, the main limitation with his very large sample was that it wasn't as representative as one would now expect a study of that kind to be. So the restrictions of interpreting Kinsey's data is that it is probably fairly representative of college-educated white men and women, but is not so good when you get outside that range. But for that segment of the population, I think it was a very good analysis of what was happening in people's lives at that time. And, of course, what caused such a stir was that it confronted the world with the fact that women were much more sexual than they were meant to be. That sort of opened up the ability to discuss this. It's become a much more talked about topic since then. But I think, contrary to the views of those who see Kinsey as the architect and the cause of the sexual revolution, what he basically did was to uncover the fact that it was getting underway. That women were changing and had started to change, perhaps particularly after the Second World War.
And we should explain that as a scientist, Kinsey was what we would call an ethnographer. He conducted most of his research by conducting, either he himself or his colleagues would conduct detailed interviews with individual subjects, both men and women. And the books were essentially compilations and analyses and conclusions drawn from those mounds and mounds, hundreds and hundreds of individual interviews. Is that correct?
Well, there were 18,000 by the time the data was finally collected. Yes, and they were long interviews with a lot of detail. I think Kinsey had a remarkable ability, given that he was trained as a biologist who studied gall wasps. He had a remarkable ability to put people at ease and enable them to talk about something which was very difficult for people to talk about at that point in history. And a lot of people, and we've had many accounts of this, have said how liberating it was to be able to open up and talk about their sexual lives and feelings with someone who was non-judgmental. Kinsey wanted to emphasize in presenting his results the extraordinary variability of human sexuality, which I think is a very important aspect of Kinsey's research.
Mm-hmm. In some lectures that you've given in the last couple of years to students here at Indiana University in a couple of different contexts, one of the things you've described how sexuality and sexual attitudes have changed over the last 50 years. And at the top of the list, your list of significant changes, significant developments in sexuality over time, was the changing role of women. Why should we see this social and political and cultural change in the status of women as an important force in thinking about how sex and sexuality have changed in the past half century?
Sex and the status of women in society are very closely related. The patriarchal society that has prevailed through most of history, where men have dominated women, has been in large part a process of containing women sexually. And there has been, it would seem, concern about amongst men about women's sexuality that has to be contained, perhaps to allow men to keep in charge. That is a simplified view of it, but there's that element there. So I think that when women start to get more power, more influence, more independence, then it is inevitable that their experience and their expectations about sex will change with it, and that's what's been happening.
Okay. In conjunction with the 50th anniversary and the events this year, the Institute has recently released some new research about women's sexuality, specifically research which is making headlines in various places and been in both the print and electronic media. Broadly speaking, what are these conclusions? What are these findings? What have the new studies being released by the Institute told us about women, and why are they newsworthy?
Well, we have recently reported results from a survey of women in the United States, heterosexual women, women in heterosexual relationships. And the research was driven by a need to identify what is important for women in their sexual lives, what is important for their sexual well-being, and what are the important factors leading to sexual problems or distress in women's lives. And the reason why that has become increasingly important is that in the medical field, the attention to sexual problems in women has been very much modeled on men's sexuality. And that hasn't been too much of an issue because the medical profession hasn't paid too much attention to women's sexuality until relatively recently. What I call the post-Viagra phenomenon, which it's been realized that a large amount of money can be made selling drugs that enhance sexual response and enjoyment in men, has led to the question about whether there is the same market in women. And therefore, it's become a hot topic. What are women's sexual problems? What are the underlying factors? And to what extent might drugs be relevant to them? So that is the motivation behind our study. And what we find is that the factors that predict sexual concern and distress in women are more to do with the emotional components of the sexual interaction and the woman's well-being and mood than they are to do with the more physiological components of the woman's sexual response, which would suggest that the role of drugs like Viagra would not be particularly large in dealing with the problems of women.
Mm-hmm. There's a stereotype that sex, the physical act of sex and what's involved in that is simply more important to men than it is to women. And some people, for ideological reasons or other reasons, might reject that as somehow a sexist idea, an idea that labels men and women as being fundamentally different in some way. It sounds as though some of the research that you're talking about may underscore and validate that idea.
Yes and no. I'm left with I think women are different to men. I believe, and this is one of my interpretations of Kinsey's data, because I think he got some of these things wrong, that women are much more profoundly influenced by social factors, by social inhibitions than men are. And I'm still curious to know to what extent this primary concern with the emotional quality of the relationship rather than the enjoyment of the sexual process is a result of sort of social conditioning, which is more powerful in women than it is in men, and which might vary across different cultures.
As this new information from the Kinsey Institute spreads through the media, it will provide an opportunity to once again observe the role that the media play in educating people and providing information about sexuality. Defining the media broadly, newspapers, television, the World Wide Web, you have observed that the media play a sort of norm-setting role about sex, but you've also described aspects of the media as being out of control and worried, I think, about the role, what the media tell people, particularly young people, about sex.
Well, yes. I mean, young people are bombarded with messages through the media in ways which they weren't when I was a teenager. And not all the messages are ones that I'm particularly happy with, and there's this extraordinary focus on women being sexually attractive and on men being sexually effective and so on. So I think the media can play good and bad roles, and I think that's inevitable. We live in an age when the media is increasingly influencing people's lives, and one of our main concerns at the Kinsey Institute is the impact of the internet, and some of our research is focused on that. And with the internet, we see very positive effects in people's sexual lives, but we also see some very negative effects too.
Briefly, what are some of the effects in both categories?
Well, positive effects are that the internet is a very powerful way of getting information to people, making it accessible. It's also a way for people to find others like themselves. And in the sexual sphere, that's always been important because a lot of people feel unusual and different and odd and unique. And being able to connect with other people who have similar sexualities to them, I think, can be very liberating and reassuring. At the same time, the extraordinary wealth of a range of sexual messages and stimuli on the internet can shape people's sexuality in ways which I think can be disturbing and indeed which cause problems in their relationships with their partners, with their job, and so on and so forth. People become out of control in their use of the internet, not infrequently.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take another break at this point, listen to some more music. Besides being a musician yourself, your three adult children are all musicians as well. The second piece we're going to listen to, a piece called Sometimes, features your daughter, Sophie, and her husband. Tell us just a little bit about your daughter, your other children, and their role as musicians, their lives as musicians.
My children from my first marriage, I have Sophie, a daughter, and Tom and Phil, who are identical twin boys. They're all in their mid to late 30s now, and they've all been musicians since they were six. I made sure they got proper training of the kind that I didn't get. Tom and Phil qualified as doctors, but in spite of that, they have pursued a career as professional jazz musicians. And Sophie is a singer and singing teacher and songwriter. I've really enjoyed seeing my children unfold as musicians. When I was when they were teenagers, I played in a band with them, and that was a wonderful experience. But then they got too good for me and moved on and find other pianists. So I love my kids' music.
Introduce us to the piece we're going to hear. Sometimes it was composed by Tom Lines, Sophie's husband.
Tom Lines is the bass player, and he's Sophie's husband. He's Canadian, and he wrote this particular piece, which Sophie is singing, and she's playing the guitar with him on bass.
Now that we've been around, round the band and around the table, and now that we know the words, fill my cup with the finest of wine. Wind will blow, I never thought it out, the sun can't shine. I never thought it out for all those years. I forgot about a lot of things. Now that we've been around, round the bend and around the table.
It was a piece called Sometimes, composed by Tom Lyne and performed by Tom Lyne and Sophie Bancroft, daughter of our guest on Profiles today, John Bancroft, director of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University. John, I want to quote something from an interview that you gave to another interviewer recently that describes some of the changes that have occurred over the course of your career. You said, "When I first arrived at Indiana University in the summer of 1995, that is when you first came here to accept appointment as director of the Kinsey Institute, you said, I was struck by the large number of young women walking around campus wearing shorts and exposing their often very attractive legs. It occurred to me that such a situation would have been the cause for a riot if it occurred when Kinsey was doing his research 50, 60 years ago." I know the intention of that quote was not in any way a sexist observation. It simply tells us something about the broader changes in cultural attitudes that both the campus and the larger world have seen.
And it tells something about the climate that I came from, too, why it hit me so forcefully, because it's not warm enough in England or Scotland for women to walk around like that in such large numbers. But yes, I think that is probably true, that over 50 years there has been much more freedom of how one presents oneself, particularly for women.
Mm-hmm. You have talked about how coming to the Kinsey Institute, coming to Bloomington, directing what is a very interdisciplinary institute, was a new intellectual awakening for you. How somewhat earlier in your career, your intellectual interests had narrowed and become more focused, and now coming to Kinsey had been a broadening experience for you. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I'd spent nearly 20 years in a reproductive biology unit, doing fairly essentialist scientific experiments, it was intellectually liberating to come over here. I had to put the laboratory on one side, and I needed to think about sex in the broad way, which, of course, had always appealed to me. And I guess it was a time in my own intellectual development. I've always been something of a late developer, that I started to realize that I needed some sort of broader way of conceptualizing human sexuality. I needed a grand theory. I needed a theoretical approach. And that has very much excited and influenced me since I've been here.
Are you still working on the theory? Is it something you can articulate at this point?
Well, we have developed a theoretical model we call the dual control model at the Kinsey Institute, particularly in my work with Erik Janssen. And that has been, I think, very influential on our research program, and I would like to think is going to set a new agenda for much of sex research for the next decade or so.
For the layman, in a nutshell, what does the theory say?
The theory says, and it goes to the brain, that in our brains we have a excitatory system and we have a separate and relatively independent inhibitory system. And whether we are sexual or not at any particular point in time depends on the balance between these two systems. An important part of our theory, and this is where I think Alfred Kinsey would approve, is that we are postulating that people vary considerably in their propensity for both excitation on the one hand and inhibition on the other hand. And we have developed a method of measuring these propensities and indeed shown that there is considerable variability in the normal population.
We're circling back to talking about some of your own research, in particular the studies you have personally led and been involved in here since being director of the Kinsey Institute. I gather that what you've just described is related to a major study that you've been involved with on sexual risk-taking, that is why, how, under what circumstances people engage in sexually risky behavior. Why is that important for us to think about and for research to illuminate some ideas about?
Well, of course, one of the main sources of funding, probably the most important source of funding for research that has anything to do with sex over the last 10 years or so has been in relation to sexually transmitted disease and in particular HIV and AIDS. And I didn't really get into that area of research until I came over here, and what struck me is how little attention was being paid to the sex part of high-risk sexual behavior. Most of the emphasis was on giving people information about what was risky and how they should avoid that risk. What we're interested in is the impact of being sexual on whether you take risks or not. So our study has looked at two particular things that have been very interesting. One is the impact of being sexually aroused, whether you are more likely to take risks when you're sexually aroused. And the other one is the impact of one's mood on your sexual behavior, whether you're more likely to take sexual risks when you're in a negative mood state. And this is where our dual control model, theoretical model, comes in, because we postulate that people vary, that the average, what you might call normal person, is going to inhibit sexual response and arousal in situations which are risky or dangerous, and that maybe the person who is most likely to take risks is the person who has this relatively low level of inhibition. So we have been using a measure of inhibition proneness to explore risk-taking, and we found that it is a strong predictor in both gay men and straight men. As far as mood is concerned, we have also found, and this is a new area of research, that people vary in the relationship between their mood and their sexuality, that there is an important minority of individuals who, when they're in a negative mood state, experience an increase in their sexual interest, and that this pattern is an important factor in getting people into risky situations. It's also very important to the development of what is sometimes called compulsive sexual behavior.
Mm-hmm. One of the hallmarks of your tenure as director of the Kinsey Institute has been opening its doors, both figuratively and literally, to the broader general public, especially the art collections and library collections of the Institute. Why did you believe that this was important?
Well, there are two principal types of reason there. The positive reason is that we have some wonderful things. in the Kinsey Institute. And I, in my time there, I have got so much pleasure or amusement from seeing these as I walk around and look at the collections and so on, that I've been really wanting to share them with other people. And they have somewhat been under lock and key. So opening up in order to share, not everything that we have there, because we have a lot of material there, which I think is important that we keep, because it helps us and other scholars to understand various aspects of sexual behavior, but which I wouldn't particularly want to share openly with the general public. But we have quite a lot of stuff that I'm very comfortable sharing, and we've been doing that, and people have been loving it, mm-hmm. Both with tours of the Institute and with public exhibits.
We're talking about paintings, etchings, sculpture,
photography,
all media of right. art. One of the projects recently that came out of all this was something called Sex and Humor, right. Which seems to, in some ways, if I can make a personal observation, parallel your sort of rather wry take on things. What was the motivation behind Sex and Humor?
Well, I believe that sex plays a very important role in humor, and indeed humor plays a very important role in sex and in society in various ways. So that's been an interesting theoretical issue for me for a long time. And in our collections, we have a lot of material which is funny. A lot of sexual humor is I think, very repressive and sexist. And that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about more open and unrepressive, unprejudiced types of humor, which just laughs at the absurdity of our sexuality in all of us. And I was delighted that we were able to share some of that with other people.
You've announced your impending retirement as director of the Kinsey Institute at the end of this calendar year. 50 years from now, if the then director of the Kinsey Institute sits down for an interview like this one, what do you expect will be some of the main points that that director will be talking about, making observations about, concluding about how sexuality will change in the next half century?
Well, I can fantasize for you about how I would like things to change, but whether they will is another matter. Things are, on the other hand, changing at a somewhat alarming pace. I would like to think that 50 years from now, there will be no issue about whether sex is something that deserves serious scholarly academic study and research, that there won't be political opposition to funding of research, and there won't be an ongoing campaign to close down sex research institutes like Kinsey. I would hope that society will have matured out of that phase. And I would hope that there would have been substantial changes in sexual behavior and values about sex. I think that the call to action for sexual health and responsible sexual behavior that was issued by the Surgeon General David Satcher in 2001, an initiative which I played a small part in, I'm pleased to say, as an advisor, will have taken root and influenced social attitudes. It emphasizes the importance of all of us being responsible in our sexual lives. And sex undoubtedly requires responsibility. It emphasizes the need to respect diversity in people's sexual lives and the ability to do that more easily if it's combined with responsibility. So I would like to see sex in 50 years' time become predominantly a part of people's lives which is managed responsibly, which is predominantly used for the purposes of fostering intimacy and bonding relationships, as well as responsibly used for its basic purpose of reproduction.
As we leave the program, we'll be listening to the Gershwin song Embraceable You, as performed by Sarah Vaughan. John, briefly, why did you choose this piece of music?
It's one of my favorite pieces of music. I think it's sublime. Whenever I listen to it, I get tinglings all over my body. It's lovely.
John Bancroft, director of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University, thanks very much for being our guest on Profiles.
It's been a pleasure.
For Profiles and for WFIU, I'm Steve Sanders.
Embrace me, my sweet embrace. embrace of the leaves.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in January of 2003, Christina Kuzmich, producer. The recording engineer and editor was Michael Paskash, Luann Johnson, research assistant. For WFIU, thanks for listening.